You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Reed Mittenbuehler is my guest tonight. He is the author of Bourbon Empire, The Past and Future of America's Whiskey. He's contributed to many publications, including The Atlantic, Slate, and The Daily Beast. His new book is called Wild Minds, The Artists and Rivalries That Inspired the Golden Age of Animation. Reed Mittenbuehler, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me on.
I loved your book. It was a great ride. And it's astounding how many Golden Age cartoons are just completely unacceptable today. It's not because they're not funny, because they're hugely funny, but there's so much racist and sexist content. And I think this is something that has been, people who teach film appreciation, as I do, have been dealing with when, you know, showing early film to young audiences. Were the animators just completely oblivious to any of this? Because,
you know, it's something I thought about a lot while I was writing the book. And one thing I really wanted to get across is that why a lot of these cartoons definitely don't pass muster by today's standards, I think it's important that we're really careful about judging the people that made them too harshly. You know, that's one thing that today it seems like there's a little bit of a surplus of, quite frankly, especially on social media. It's just this, like, this judgment, you know, assuming that they were bad or that their intentions were bad or whatever. And when you go back and you look at these cartoons within the context of the times in which they are made, like, yeah, there are definitely moments that are racist or sexist, but there's also moments that are really beautiful. And I think that that really is their heritage more, you know, than those other things. And also one of the most pleasant surprises I had while doing the research is that when you start to dig, you'd find that the people who created them in their own time were concerned about a lot of the same issues that we're concerned about today. And doesn't necessarily translate today, you know, that art that they're making, but they were also, you know, concerned about certain issues of social justice, about the immigrant experience, about things like this. And, you know, when you go through and you look at old interviews with a lot of them, you know, that I think it's always very surprising, you know, that they were trying to say something that I think a lot of people today, in a lot of ways, would actually agree with. You know, there are a lot of very racist images. Yes, it was very oblivious. I think it was more thoughtless than it was specifically malign. But that's something that I think is important to keep in mind, because there's a lot of beauty and poetry in them, and, you know, that's worth enjoying today too.
I had never even thought about Pepe Le Pew as being offensive. I mean, I just think that it's hilarious. And the plot is always the same. He's a skunk who's completely oblivious to his own odor and finds a cat that has inadvertently got himself painted like a skunk and forces himself on her. And I could see now that someone who had been abused sexually or had someone force themselves on them would see that, you know, would have PTSD and watch those cartoons in horror.
Yeah. Well, that's a perfect example too of, while I was doing book research, I kind of got curious and I was like, you know, Pepe Le Pew, you know, I was watching someone with my wife and we're laughing pretty hard. They're very funny, but we're also laughing in a way at just how outrageous they would be today. It's like, wow, like this would not land very well. And I went out and I just started, you know, searching around, and there were, you know, go out online, something you should probably always be careful about doing, but there were some people who were very upset, you know, and they were railing pretty hard against Pepe Le Pew cartoons. And that's a good example of that kind of context I was talking about before, is that a big part of the creative team behind them, Chuck Jones and Michael Maltese, they were actually using those cartoons to criticize a lot of the behavior that today they're accused of. So for instance, there was kind of an in-house joke at the Warner Brothers studio. They were using those cartoons to make fun of a colleague of theirs who, a lot of times, you know, on Monday after the weekend, he'd come back to work, and as an animator, he's very good looking, he's very handsome, and he could never understand why, you know, the women he talked to that weekend really didn't have any interest in him. Like, why wouldn't they even be interested in a guy like me? He's a little bit like Pepe Le Pew that way. Just can't fathom why these women just really have no interest. And so they were using those cartoons in a way to make fun of that, to kind of poke fun at their friend, like, well, you know, maybe they're not interested because they're just not interested. Just accept it. And Chuck Jones also wanted to use the character to explore a little bit of his own psyche. You know, he'd said when he was a kid, he was kind of gangly and knock-kneed, and he was very uncomfortable around females. And when he was young, this idea of Pepe, you know, super suave and whatever, was sort of his idea of masculinity when he was a kid. And then he, as he got older, realized that that wasn't necessarily a good thing, and that wasn't the way he wanted to be. And he was using the cartoon to make fun of himself a little bit, to make fun of that behavior. So there's also kind of a warning against that kind of behavior embedded in these cartoons. And once that context is added, once you learn that, I think that those cartoons a lot of times take on a whole different meaning. They're much more fun again. They're kind of making fun of it, and they can serve a valuable purpose. If you just watch them in that kind of superficial way, like, oh, they're condoning this and they're glorifying this, that wasn't always the case. And so that's important to know, I think, when assessing these cartoons today.
One of the stories that you tell, Reed Mittenbuehler, in your book, The Wild Minds, The Artists and Rivalries That Inspired the Golden Age of Animation, is the story of this cartoon called Coal Black and the Seven Dwarfs. And it's a hilarious cartoon, but again, it would be unacceptable to audiences today. But you said that that African Americans contributed to the cartoon and wanted the cartoon to be made.
That's a really interesting one. It's a little bit of the backstory on Coal Black, very controversial cartoon, and that is a really good example of a cartoon that would not pass muster today. I mean, when you watch it today, it I won't get into the details of exactly what you see, but it can be very, very offensive, especially to African-Americans. And not just African-Americans. I mean, it's pretty across the board. There's all kinds of groups. But the story behind it, so it's a parody of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, because the Warner Brothers animators were always kind of making fun of their counterparts at the Disney studio and poking fun at that style of cartoon. And Bob Clampett, who directed the cartoon, he's a legendary Warner Brothers animator, he was a big jazz fan. And one day he was at a jazz concert in Los Angeles. He went to go see Duke Ellington, Duke Ellington's Revue. And after the show, he was hanging out backstage and he's talking to musicians, and eventually they find out who he is, you know, that he's this famous cartoon director. And they said, well, why don't you ever make cartoons about us? And his quote about it was, you know, and I thought to myself, that's a good question. Why don't I? So he invited a bunch of them to the studio to collaborate on this cartoon, you know, writing the gags, especially writing the music. He really wanted to celebrate this jazz. And a lot of people got on board. Apparently Louis Armstrong wanted to contribute a voice, wasn't able to because he was off, you know, touring. But Vivian Dandridge, a lot of great musicians, great talent got involved. Unfortunately, a lot of them weren't credited. You know, it's a very complicated story, but the studio owner, he had musicians already, you know, on the payroll. So he's not going to pay these jazz musicians, you know, for something he's already paying for, you know, that kind of thing. Although they contributed this outstanding soundtrack to the cartoon. And he had wanted to call it So White and the Seven Dwarfs, you know, which is kind of questioning just the assumptions that you'd see in the title, like Snow White and that kind of stuff. But they couldn't do that because they were worried about lawsuits from Disney. So they called it Coal Black and the Seven Dwarfs. And so when the film comes out, it got mixed reviews, but it's interesting to see how the reviews were mixed. You had some African-American audiences that loved it. You know, they really appreciated how it celebrated jazz. It celebrated this art form that at that time in American history, you know, I remember people were calling it, you know, gutter music, and they were criticizing it as this great art form. They really appreciated it. They also appreciated how it was moving away from the stereotype of a rural sort of minstrelsy, you know, and it was looking at how a lot of African Americans had migrated to cities, and, you know, their lifestyles were becoming more urban and upwardly mobile. So that was something that pleased a lot of people. And then a lot of people just found it offensive for when you watch the movie, you'll see all the reasons why. The United States government was also very critical of it. And they're like, oh, you know, this isn't good for, you know, this pushes a lot of stereotypes. But it's funny because their criticism then added, but it does have good boogie-woogie music. You know, so it's like this whole thing. You know, the NAACP was critical, but they were critical for reasons that I thought were really interesting because it was during World War II, and their main criticism was how African Americans were depicted as soldiers, and the dwarves in the film were soldiers. And they're like, well, it demeans the contribution that a lot of African Americans are making to the war effort right now, which I think is really important and really strong criticism. And, you know, they're saying this is something that the Japanese soldiers right now are using against us. Like, they're in propaganda, they're saying, like, they're kind of trying to, they're doing broadcasts to African-American soldiers saying, well, look how you're treated in your own country. And we're sort of playing up to that, you know, with this cartoon. And so the cartoon's interesting on a lot of really different levels for that, the mixed reviews and, you know, what Bob Clampett was trying to do, how it comes off today. And, you know, when he was asked about it later, because it's since been censored and Warner's doesn't distribute it, and quite frankly, I probably wishes it just didn't exist. He was a little defensive. Like, I think people need to understand exactly what was going on. So that's just one of the many examples in the story of how when you go beneath that surface story just a little bit, the backstory just brings up all kinds of extra relevant nuance and context that I think is important. And I think will change a lot of people's opinions of stuff that superficially appears really bad. And sometimes it is. I mean, but it's worth arguing about. It's worth having a discussion, I think.
And your book does a great job of doing that. It's interesting because Bill Dana, who was a comedian who played a character on television and on comedy records called Jose Jimenez, today that would be completely unacceptable, but at the time he got a Hispanic Heritage Award for honoring Hispanics with his his caricature of Jose Jimenez. And both David O. Selznick, when he made Gone with the Wind, and Walt Disney, when he made Song of the South, made efforts, reached out to the African-American community and made sure that they weren't making an offensive film. And Song of the South is a movie that I'm sure the Disney Corporation wishes didn't exist, in the same way that Warner Brothers wishes Cold Black didn't exist.
Right. And as you said, that was one where Walt Disney did reach out to the NAACP, you know, as consultants. I would, you know, the NAACP, they couldn't come out and consult on it. They couldn't fly out. I think the expense and other reasons. He did reach out. I think a lot of people fairly are a little worried sometimes when they get reached out in that way, that they're just looking for a rubber stamp approval. And that film certainly doesn't age very well at all. Yeah. Song of the South. It was, but he did try. But when you look at it today, especially as our understanding of things have evolved and we've become more sensitive in ways, everyone falls flat in a lot of ways. Walt Disney was also going through a very weird time when that film came out. The studio was transitioning, and, you know, it's interesting to talk to people about Walt's politics today. He wasn't really a particularly political man. I mean, he had started, you know, as a Democrat, he'd voted Democrat, but then he later became a Republican, which back then was a very different thing, I think, today being a Republican is. But his big issue was unions. You know, his studio had unionized, and he was worried about losing it. And that's the thing he cared about. You know, it was funny because he was criticized at one point after Song of the South by some African-American papers. And his response to the criticism, it wasn't about race. It wasn't racist. All he cared about was like, well, are they communists? Because you know, it was the union thing. He had a fixation on that. And that was really his issue. If he had a particularly strong political issue, that was it.
He was personally offended by his artists going on strike and wanting to unionize.
He's absolutely, you know, perfectly offended. And that happened at a transition in his life when he was becoming more corporate. You know, the first 20, 25 years of his career, and I like to trace this out in the book, he was very, a very eccentric dresser. And he was very artistic. And a lot of artists, even quote unquote high artists, you know, Thomas Mann, Salvador Dali, Thomas Hart Benton, they're hanging out at the studio. They wanted to work with Orson Welles, wanted to work with Walt Disney. A lot of newspapers and magazine sources, you know, a lot of critics, very, very kind of arch high critics were huge fans of the man. And then starting in the 50s, you're having this cultural change. Walt is also changing and he's starting to show up on TV. So this is the public perception of him changed a lot because of his own doing. He's on TV, he's wearing the suits. He's seen in a very different light. And that's how people today remember him as. I think a lot of people today react to the symbol of Walt Disney more than they react to the person. That term Disneyfication is sometimes used as a pejorative to criticize, you know, corporate ownership and things like that. But Walt Disney was actually as a person very different than all of that. And his art, especially in those first 20 years, I think was very different and occupied a very different place in American culture than we today remember it as having occupied. So it's interesting to look at him that way. He was assessed differently in different times.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking this week with Reed Mittenbuehler. He's the author of Wild Minds, The Artists and Rivalries That Inspired the Golden Age of Animation.
Well, there's a couple of things in your book that make me think about the contributions of Walt Disney, because Disney was not the artist or the director or even the producer of most of the material that came out of his studio. And yet when he lost Oswald the Rabbit, in 1928 to, you can tell us about how it was sort of stolen from him. Oswald the Rabbit did not go on to become the greatest cartoon character of all time. And we don't wear Oswald the Rabbit watches and hats. And when Ub Iwerks left the studio in 1929, I think it was, he did not go on to become the greatest cartoon creator of all time. So it really was, it was Walt is the, it was the defining thing that made Walt Disney Studios so great.
Yeah. And even Iwerks, who, you know, had a huge contribution in the creation of Mickey Mouse, as you just said, it's like he didn't go off to become, oh, the actual Walt Disney. And so I think what's really interesting about Walt is that here's someone who, even by his own admission, you know, wasn't the greatest artist, you know, in the studio. People said he was a brilliant gag man. He was really good at coming up with gags, and he had a pretty incredible story sense. But there was a genius to him. But his genius was in marshaling, in a kind of a producing kind of way, marshaling the talents of other geniuses in the studio. And he was a perfectionist. And so he's really driving people for work. Like, it's not good enough, it's not good enough, really pushing them to that higher level. And there's a section of the book, I kind of make a joke out of it, but I talk about duende, you know, the thing that term that Spanish poets use for, you know, sometimes a work of genius can come out of a semi-literate artist. But they just get something, there's a knack. And Walt Disney had that knack. And there's this whole roster of films that he was involved with that are great. And yeah, he might not have been doing every specific thing, but his name was on them. And as animators, that sometimes rubbed them the wrong way. You know, Walt would say, it's my name up there. It's a Walt Disney production, where, you know, he had tons of people working at the studio that were brilliant at these very specific things, but he was able to corral all that talent and somehow get it to work in films, which, you know, are really hard to make.
It's interesting that it's an industry in which it is an industry, but it is also an art.
Right. Absolutely. You know, as an industry, they've got those concerns about making money. And it's a little different than live action, where you just plunk down a camera and you can film. And it's not that that's cheap, but animation takes so many hours to, you know, you've got to draw basically back then, especially these little paintings. You know, all this work, it was expensive to do. So, you know, you had to make sure it was profitable in order to justify making more of it. High stakes with animation.
Yeah, I mean, the one of the things that's so fascinating that runs through the thread that runs through Wild Minds is the rivalry between Max Fleischer and Walt Disney. And I didn't realize until I read your book that Max Fleischer might have made his feature first if he had had his own studio and wasn't working under the auspices of another studio.
Right. Well, so when I first started this book, the Max Fleischer Walt Disney relationship, you know, I for a while I was thinking maybe that is the book, because with Max Fleischer you have this character, and for people who don't know who are listening, you know, Max Fleischer and his brothers, their studio that's Betty Boop, you know, Popeye, these other famous characters, New York
great Superman cartoons.
Yeah, they put out the Superman, and right when the Superman cartoons were coming out in the early 40s, that's when Fleischer lost control of his studio. So a lot of those were made under different ownership. But you've got this character who's a little like Scottie Pippen. And you think about Scottie Pippen, arguably, it's arguable, but he's arguably the second best player in the NBA when he's playing. Unfortunately, he has to play under the shadow of not only the best player in the NBA at the time, Michael Jordan, but arguably the best player of all time. And, you know, and so it's like, and Scottie Pippen's name is very well known because he was so good, you know, part of the dynasty and everything. Max Fleischer, the Fleischer brothers' best work rivals some of Disney's best work. You know, overall, Disney's work, you know, generally, I think, hit a little bit higher. But their work, it was different. It was a little more funky. It was a little more surreal. It was out of New York. They looked at different issues. There were different themes that they explored. You know, the immigrant experience. They were Jewish, and a lot of that culture worked its way into their cartoons. And they, you know, Max Fleischer isn't the household name today. I bet if you went out on the street and just started asking random people, do you know who Max Fleischer is? I mean, you're going to get a lot of blank stares. Everyone knows who Disney, he's an icon. I mean, he's up there with Mark Twain. He's up there with presidents. I mean, everyone knows Disney. And Max Fleischer, you know, there's a story you brought up. You know, he had wanted to be the first to do a feature cartoon. And there have been some kind of art films that were features, some European films are really kind of the first features, but the first big feature, and though we think of features, especially in the US, Snow White. Well, and Max Fleischer had also wanted to make one, but you know, the studios were wary, you know, the financiers were wary of it, but no one had done it before. And Walt Disney or Max Fleischer did end up making Gulliver's Travels, but it came out a couple years after Snow White. But there's a story in the book where Snow White premiered at Radio City Music Hall in New York. And Radio City Music Hall sat on top of the site where Max Fleischer's boyhood home had been. Like, his home was razed to make way for Radio City Music Hall. And the family moved to Brooklyn. They lived in various neighborhoods in Brooklyn. But when Max Fleischer is walking down the street during the premiere of Snow White, he looked down at the pavement because he didn't want to look up and see the name of his prime competitor, you know, in lights on the site of his boyhood home. I mean, it's just so symbolic in so many ways, and kind of a sad story that he doesn't receive as much credit, you know, today for being another great artist.
And he, Max Fleischer would curse anytime the name of Walt Disney was mentioned, but did Disney curse when Max Fleischer was mentioned, or he was just didn't care?
Not that we know of. He was very gracious to Max Fleischer. You know, Max Fleischer would always curse, and that cursing, you know, kind of came, and I was like that SOB. But there is an interesting story where, so Richard Fleischer, who's Max Fleischer's son, who became a very successful director. He directed 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, directed Tora, Tora, Tora. He's got a bunch of movies. But Richard Fleischer, when he got the job of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, because that was a Disney production, he meets with Walt Disney and he says, you know who my father is, right? When he got offered the job. And Walt Disney, because Walt Disney and Max Fleischer had never met. They'd never actually met. Yeah, he was, you know, East Coast, West Coast. And Walt Disney was very gracious. He goes, of course I know who your father is. And he goes, I do have to ask, you know, before taking this job. And he calls his father, and Max Fleischer was like, are you kidding me? Absolutely, take the job. Like, you know, it's like, what? And so he takes the job, and the movie's a big success. And then later, Max Fleischer came out to California to visit. And a meeting was arranged where he goes to the Disney studio and he gets to meet Walt Disney, and he's walking around the studio, and the studio is full of animators who used to work for him. They're always poaching each other's talent. And all the animators, they always wanted to go work for Disney because Disney poured tons of money into training his artists. He had these schools. I mean, and it was, everyone talked about Disney. It was these huge, ambitious films. It was the place to be. And a lot of Max's talent basically got poached from him. There was a period where he poached some of it back, you know, kind of go back and forth. But really, the movement of those animators was from the Fleischer Studio to the Disney Studio. But he had this wonderful lunch with a lot of his old animators, and everyone kind of soiree'd him a little bit. And Walt Disney was very gracious. But there's this kind of bittersweet note at the end of it where Rich Fleischer, his quote, I'm going to paraphrase him, but he looks at his dad at that meeting, and he sees his dad, he's lost his studio, and quite frankly, isn't doing very well financially, and he's been forgotten. And here he is with Walt Disney, who's in the process of building the amusement parks, and the empire is only getting bigger. And when he looks at his dad sitting next to Walt Disney at lunch, he says, you know, it's like seeing David get defeated by Goliath. And it's kind of this sad little note. Yeah, but Walt never rubbed it in. He was never mean about it. But that's just how it goes.
Yeah, interesting story. And of course, when you look at all the animators that worked in the era that you write about in Wild Minds, almost all of them had worked for Disney at one time or another, including the Carl Stalling, the guy who wrote the music for all the Warner Brothers cartoons. He also wrote the Skeleton Dance and created the Silly Symphonies with Walt, right?
The Skeleton Dance, which is probably one of the best cartoons of all time, the yep. Disney cartoon. Yeah, there was a lot of going back and forth, a lot of cross-pollination. That was a fun thing to explore in the book, too, was how you'd see different philosophies come out of these different studios. You know, the Disney studio is known for... Yeah, like the little more rural settings, like the more that Midwestern kind of thing that reflected Walt's upbringing, whereas New York...
It's always farm animals everywhere you look.
Right. Whereas the Fleischer cartoons, yeah, it's New York, it's the Lower East Side, it's Brooklyn, and you're seeing a lot of New York in-jokes and things like that. And then the Warner Brothers animators, it was a little more zany, it was a little more... There was a more anarchy going on, and a lot of them had worked at a lot of these other studios, but... You know, they were under Warner Brothers, and Billy Wilder had this quote about the old studios. I think really more so back then than, you know, today. Today, studios have a signature, and you're like, okay, you know what kind of movie you're getting. But back then, you really know, like MGM, that was kind of like very name brand. You know, Warner Brothers was a little more, you know, that's where the film noirs were coming from. You had Humphrey Bogart. He was a studio actor there. And so the Warner cartoon unit kind of reflected that a little bit more of that edgy, anarchic, like we can push back a little bit. And they would do that to, you know, Disney. They're always making fun of Disney cartoons in the Looney Tunes and Merry Melodies. And there were some Disney animators who were like, you know, they envied them a little bit. They envied them their freedom. And you know, they've got Walt, who's very, you know, he's a perfectionist, he's very controlling. Whereas the Warner Brother animators were left a little bit more to their own devices. Just do whatever you think is funny. Be bawdy. You can be a little bit more raw. And some of the Disney animators looked at that and envied it. And there was a quote from one, I'll paraphrase, but he was like, you know, yeah, Disney cartoons get chuckles, but man, those Warner Brothers cartoons, they get laughs. You know, and they knew it. You know, they got it. But then, you know, Warner Brothers animators have to be envying the resources that the Disney guys had. So... There's all, you know, a lot of these competitions, a lot of these rivalries. That was fun to explore.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking this week with Reed Mittenbuehler. He's the author of Wild Minds, The Artists and Rivalries That Inspired the Golden Age of Animation.
And Warner Brothers came up with some of the most enduring characters, and you spent some time in your book talking about the Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote. And Chuck Jones's rules for those cartoons. When you look at them, you think, yeah, I mean, those rules really define the humor of those cartoons. And it's amazing how you can watch one after the other, and they're still hilariously funny, even though they all have the exact same plot.
Yeah, so precise, you know, those cartoons are. And there's all these rules, and it reminds me a little bit of a haiku, right? Where, you know, some people think that to create art, you need to have no limits and, you know, total and complete freedom to do whatever you want. But sometimes having limits and bounds around yourself can kind of help unleash a different kind of freedom. Like, for instance, you know, the Hays Code, putting restrictions on sexuality and what can be shown, you know, forced writers to come up with all kinds of very creative double entendres that, quite frankly, are a little more interesting to hear. You know, how do they creatively work their way around these obstacles? He's got all these rules around the Wile E. Coyote Roadrunner cartoons, and it really raised them to a higher level. There was a story from Chuck Jones' youth where that lesson really sunk in. He grew up in LA. He's a huge fan of Charlie Chaplin, and as a kid would go over and watch Chaplin filming. Silent day, you know, in the silent years, they'd film outside because they didn't really worry about noise, and kids would line up on the fence and they'd watch. And Chaplin was very gracious, and he'd come over and he'd talk to the kids. But Chuck Jones could remember seeing Chaplin just do multiple takes, you know, taking dozens of takes of a scene. And then, you know, that precision really sunk in. You realize this is hard work. I mean, you don't just come up with this stuff. And every last detail was figured out right down to the atom level.
In those Roadrunner cartoons, so much of the humor comes from the timing of the calamities that happen to the coyote. And that your book points out that all of those calamities are his own doing. The Roadrunner never does anything mean. He just beep beeps and runs.
Right. Well, that's what's so great about it is that, you know, you've got this chase cartoon and the loser, who's always losing, the coyote, is the smart one. Like, he's really smart. And Roadrunner is kind of dumb, but he's always successful just through sheer dumb luck. And that's one of the rules Chuck talked about, is, you know, the coyote is always defeated by his own ineptitude. And he and Michael Maltese, the main creative duo behind those cartoons, the first one came out in 1949, so it's kind of a 1950s cartoon, you know, when you think about it, that series. And there's a lot of America at that time reflected in them. You know, they're set in the American Southwest. They've got the desert, which is this symbol of the American frontier, the symbol of freedom, westward expansion. You know, it's important. The coyote was inspired by Mark Twain's coyote from Roughing It. You know, Chuck Jones read about that when he was just a kid, and the image that Twain had painted of the coyote of, you know, being this allegory of want and paragrazing it, but he wanted that to also be symbolic in coyote. But this coyote who's always defeated by his own ineptitude, Chuck Jones remembered reading the newspapers at the time. He's got this growing military industrial complex, and he read about this, you know, $1 million rocket that exploded because of the failure of a 35-cent part. And he's like, he's always defeated by something similar, you know, and there were a lot of lessons lodged in that just about America. You know, that's one of the things that makes those cartoons work so well and on so many layers, is they were speaking to certain kind of truths about the American experience. And I think that those deserve to be part of, you know, the American canon as much as anything. I mean, they really are brilliant, and they just, so many layers to them. They're perfect. They're perfect little gems.
Well, that reminds me of Jay Ward, because when the studios stopped making short subjects, and so television came in and animation moved to television, that's when animation became for kids. It wasn't for kids in any of the other history of animation. They made them for theatrical release when everybody went to the theater.
Yeah,
And so then when you see those Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoons that you write about, they operate on two or three levels. I think they operate on three levels. Level one is you're 5 years old and it's got color and there's stuff happening and it's amusing. And then when you're 12 years old, you start to get some of the jokes that you weren't getting when you watched it when you were five. And then when you were 30, you saw all these other jokes that you thought, oh my God, there are a lot of jokes that were for adults in those cartoons.
Yeah. Well, that's something I realized, you know, when I first got the idea to write this book, I remember, you know, I remember thinking, as an adult, I'm watching a Looney Tune, and I hadn't watched them in a long time. And I remember laughing as a kid and thinking that they're funny. But as an adult, I'm laughing far harder than I ever had as a kid. and I'm seeing jokes about politics of the era and of the time. I'm like, that would have been way over my head back then. But yeah, you brought up the technology thing and TV and whether or not for kids or for adults, but that first 50 years, it was for adults, and all those animators, including Walt Disney, were adamant about that. They're like, you know, they said things like, well, I created them for myself, or, you know, it's for adults. If kids enjoyed them, that was great. I mean, it's not like they were trying to exclude kids, but if kids enjoyed them, it was the same way kids might enjoy a Chaplin film, you know, something made for adults, and they were laughing at that. And then, you know, I like exploring, there's a thread in the book about technology and how when technology changes, the art itself changes. And we see that with sound, and we see it, you know, with television. In the late 1940s, when television starts coming on the scene, here you've got this art form, animation, which has always been shown before feature films in movie theaters, you know, dark movie theaters where the revenue is generated by adults paying a ticket price. And that's how they're seen. And so they kind of adapted to that environment. All of a sudden you've got these devices, televisions, which are in people's homes where there are lots of kids around. You've got this new demographic of kids, the baby boomers, you know, running around. We've got a lot of tired parents who realize they can use these TVs as surrogate babysitters. And no longer is the revenue generated by a ticket price in a dark movie theater. It's generated by advertisements. And you've got these advertisers who all of a sudden want to say and what's going on. And it was like a sea change almost overnight. The content and the tone of cartoons just changed and became much more geared towards kids. And you had this dead slot of Saturday morning. Nobody watched TV on Saturday morning. And here's this slot. And people are like, well, what can we put there? And they look and they're like, well, we've got all these cartoons. We could just recycle it. I mean, it's kind of like the internet today. Like anything went. They were looking to fill the space. And so they start putting these cartoons out, but they're editing these cartoons, they're censoring because, like, wow, they're gonna be playing for kids, they're chopping them all up, all kinds of weird versions. These cartoons go out. And then they're playing advertisements. And the Federal Trade Commission rules at the time are actually different than they are today. You could advertise to kids at a rate of about twice what you could advertise to adults for. They closed that loophole, I believe, in the late 60s. But while you've got kids watching it, and then the advertisers are like, okay, how can we make money off this? We've got kids, and they're watching cartoons on Saturday morning. What kind of products are they most susceptible to? And the answer is pretty clear. Toys. And then sugary breakfast cereals, because they're probably hungry and going to be asking their parents for breakfast. And you have this moment where General Mills and Post, big cereal companies, are buying the rights to characters. And there's this explosion of cereals marketing to kids. And a lot of laws had to be changed around that, because it was like, well, you're starting to have commercials that you can't even discern from the programming, because the commercials are cartoons. And it's just, it's all aimed towards that one demographic. And that was kind of what defines animation for the next couple of decades.
There's some vintage animation that I think is kind of hard to see today. I remember that the Captain Crunch, for instance, Captain Crunch commercials were as funny as any cartoons that you saw on the show that it was a commercial for. You know, they would cut away to a very, very entertaining commercial. There was a Quisp and Quake, two rival cereals. Spacemen that were hilariously funny. I think Jay Ward must have done those because they kind of have a Rocky and Bullwinkle feel.
Well, and sometimes there was some really interesting talent that went to work on cartoons a little bit later. I liked looking at the HUAC, the House Un-American Activities Committee stuff in the 40s. A lot of animators, just like a lot of people in Hollywood, had been gone after by these committees. It always was great headlines for lawmakers to go after, you know, to go after Hollywood, especially around election years. And, you know, it was witch hunts, and they're looking for communists and that kind of stuff. And a lot of animators got caught out by that. You know, several did. And television offered a refuge for some of them to find work because they weren't credited. So it was hard to track a lot of them down. But it's funny because these people who were, you know, accused of communism, and a lot of those claims were baseless. A lot of them had served with distinction in World War II. A lot of them had worked for the FNPU in World War II, the first motion picture unit. But had fought in combat. Like, these are the kind of people this committee is going after, you know, just to make political hay. But it's funny because then these animators, some of them who found refuge making television commercials, being blamed, you know, they're being called communists, but they're making these pretty great commercials for some of the most capitalist corporations, you know, on earth. It's like Coca-Cola, General Electric, you know, Ford Motor Company. And that's what they're making cartoons for. But they could do it they could do it kind of undercover and not get caught. And that was the way they avoided the blacklist.
And they made some great work. You didn't mention the UPA studios, which was really kind of a whole different take on the animated cartoon.
Yeah. It, you know, getting to the rivalries theme in the book, you know, UPA started, a lot of the people who started it had started originally at Disney, but they had started at Disney. You know, there was the first crowd at Disney, which a lot of them had come from newspapers, the newspaper cartooning world, which is a little more, you know, blue collar, a little more rough. And then as Disney is vacuuming up talent, especially in the 1930s, when you got a Great Depression. So getting a job at Disney was great. Like he had, there was a level of talent working there, you know, coming out of art schools, you know, that was a lot higher than he would have probably been able to get if the economy had been doing better. So this new generation at Disney, you know, their bookshelves are sagging under the weight of books about art theory and that kind of thing. And, you know, we talked a lot earlier about Disney and the unions, and they didn't necessarily like how Disney was running the studio. And so, you know, they had political differences with Disney. And so they left and they started their own outfit, UPA. And at first, you know, they did some political films. They did one called Hellbent for Election. It's a re-election campaign cartoon for FDR. And they did training videos for the military, you know, and they did it. But their whole aesthetic, and, you know, you can see Mr. Magoo is probably their most famous character, but their whole aesthetic, it's very different. It's much more flat. It takes a lot of design and art principles from Eastern Europe. They're really into that. They had a whole different approach to animation. It wasn't like the old animation studios were run like factories. I mean, it was this division of labor. It was all very specific. And everyone at UPA was much more educated. So it was like, well, we all do everything. It was much more communal approach. And, you know, you can see that mindset coming out. You know, they had these cool jazz soundtracks. It was just a little more cerebral. And Mr. Magoo, you know, probably their most famous character, was a reaction to, you know, McCarthy. The creators one day are talking about, you know, let's come up with this character, because UPA wanted to come up with a famous character. You know, that's how studios made their names, right? And Millard Kaufman and John Hughley, you know, were talking about this character, and they took a weekend away, and they were like, you know, we both have these irascible uncles who, you know, kind of speak like, you know, they're millionaires. They kind of win their arguments by shouting everyone down, but they really can't always see past the end of their nose. And then they were talking about weird place names in California, you know, like Point Magoo, and Point Magoo is where they, you know, where they got the name. And they're sitting this weekend, they're like, you know, let's create this character, kind of make fun of that, you know, kind of create fun of this stuff that's going on right now in Washington with McCarthyism. And so there's this whole backdrop behind Mr. Magoo, this whole political thing, I think really flavors that character. There's a satire, just it's woven right into the cartoon. And that's a really cool thing about it. And that's present in a lot of the little cartoons, but that one's, I think, a particularly good story.
Very good. And there's so many of those in the book. And then the book is called Wild Minds, The Artist and Rivalries That Inspired the Golden Age of Animation. And the author is my guest, Reed Mittenbuehler. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, it's a pleasure coming on. Thanks a lot.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.